All right. Well, I think it's about that time. I think everybody's joined. So we'll go ahead and get started. My name is Annette Pham. I'm the current president of Montgomery County Medical Society. And again, as you may have heard before, just a reminder, we've muted everybody at the beginning of the call for sound quality purposes. This call is being recorded, so that will be available on our website tomorrow for your reference. So you can go back to it or share with your colleagues. So I did want to thank you for joining us today for another webinar in the Montgomery County Medical Society's Rapid Response Series, which we began at the onset of COVID-19 in our community. Certainly since early March, your medical society has been dedicated to helping physicians navigate the challenges of COVID-19 on their practices and, of course, most importantly, on our patients. We've held many webinars to keep physicians informed and produce comprehensive resources for all physicians, including the recent practice reopening toolkit, and that can be found online at montgomerymedicine.org. Tonight is a continuation of this commitment to you all in our community, and we want to continue to keep you informed about the changing landscape of COVID-19. I think we all realize that this is a fluid thing. Some of the things that we're talking about are changing sometimes by the minute. So it's our privilege to be partnering with Dr. Travis Gales, Chief Health Officer for Montgomery County, and he's going to provide us with a public health update on some biweekly calls. We'll start with this first one today. And for each call, we will also consider adding some specialists to address various aspects of the pandemic. And tonight, we're happy to welcome Dr. Michael Sari, an infectious disease and occupational medicine physician, as well as epidemiologist, who also speak about best practices of reopening and possibly some experiences he's been having treating COVID. So just a couple of housekeeping things before we start. And public service announcements, if you will, but please visit Montgomery County Medical Society's website. Again, it's montgomerycountymedicine.org and MedKai's website, medkai.org, and you can access many resources which are constantly updated there. Perhaps we can put that in the chat so you can reference that. And we do encourage your participation in the Dr. Hast calls. They've been very helpful in keeping us informed about what's been going on in all of Maryland. The link to participate in these calls can be found in the email that you receive from MedKai. And those are on Mondays and Wednesdays at 5 o'clock and on Fridays at 12. And I think that if you fill out an evaluation, you can also get some CME as well. And in any case, we understand that acquiring enough PPE to open is a challenge. While you may have adequate PPE for 2 weeks, you may not know when you can acquire more. In addition to being able to access PPE throughout the county health department, MCMS has rolled out a new partnership with Handcraft Linen to help you acquire adequate PPE. So you can look for information about this in the e-news. So you can also complete a PPE form with the County Health Department, and Dr. Gales can also speak to that. Carissa will put this link into the chat box. So with that, let's go ahead and move on to tonight's discussion. I think really we wanted to get this started because now that you know, Maryland has been opened up, Montgomery County still remains in this stay-at-home mode. So as the governor's order was released allowing reopening of medical practices for non-urgent care, we certainly are seeing some patients who are a little wary about coming in to see their physician for chronic or routine issues. So I'd like to welcome Dr. Travis Gales to provide a little bit of a quick dashboard of what is happening here in Montgomery County and to really help us navigate caring for our patients in these unprecedented times. So Dr. Gales.
Sure. Good evening, fellow colleagues. Thank you, Dr. Pham, for the opportunity to speak with you all this evening. Dashboard is the word of the day as we posted our road to reopening, I think is the term that was used, dashboard that highlighted the metrics that we talked about last week in terms of the indicators that we are looking to guide our decisions in terms of how we move forward and reopen businesses and other aspects of social and personal life. So I know that there are some, lots of great questions, so I won't talk a ton and save room for those questions. But suffice to say that the governor did make his decision to move into phase one on last Wednesday. Based upon the data that we saw at that time, we were not ready to do that. And we're not exactly ready to do that right now. However, many of the indicators that we released as guide points are moving in the right direction. We are seeing average daily decreases in cases, although yesterday gave us significant pause where we saw the highest daily count for Montgomery County and the highest daily count for the state across the board. We had over 500 cases reported here and over 1,700 cases reported at the state. I'm happy to say that today's daily count was 102, which is significantly different from yesterday. But, you know, again, it shows that we have to continue to watch the data and see where it goes. So we do have positive movement in terms of decreasing cases, but things that do give us pause in areas of concern remain our hospital capacity. For those of you who practice in the county hospital settings, you know that actually, up until recently, and still to some degree, the facilities have had to board patients in their emergency departments. So even though the volume coming into the emergency department have been lower and continuing to decrease for COVID-related illnesses, but as we'll talk about, unfortunately, for other types of illness as well, that we want to make sure that people are utilizing the resources to get the care that they need and are not waiting. And we also see that our ICU capacity has been stretched really thinly over the last 7 to 10 days. So we're continuing to watch those indicators to make sure that they drop because we want to make sure that as we slowly reopen, that we have adequate provisions within our healthcare facilities to be able to take care of patients as we resume or get close to resuming full practice, and also to be able to absorb, unfortunately, if we are to see a spike arise in new cases as we open things up. So those are the indicators we're looking to. We've made significant progress in terms of increasing testing capacity, and we'll be announcing a major effort led by the county on tomorrow that will highlight our next steps. We have been looking at ways to increase testing capacity from offering alternative test sites through the VEEP stations and other areas throughout the county, creating a mobile testing helpline for individuals who don't have access to a provider, and the creation of a mobile testing arm that is providing ready responder services to areas within the county, going into families who have been identified as high risk and high need to do testing on site, and we're looking to be able to stand up pop-up testing opportunities at different areas throughout the county. So we're increasing testing capacity. We're working with the state on contact tracing to partner together for an extremely large-scale effort that will be up and running next week. We've been contact tracing from the very beginning and continue to leverage our resources for that very important opportunity. The last component I'll mention in terms of dashboards of what we're measuring is the concept of equity. Now, we have seen evidence that COVID, the illness, has disproportionately impacted communities of color. We've seen a higher number of cases, or at least within the data, the limited data that we do have race and ethnicity on in cases impacting the Latino community. And when we look at COVID-related fatalities, the death rate for Black residents of Montgomery County is significantly higher than other groups. So we know that we have seen COVID-related disparities. but that shouldn't surprise any of us in the practice of medicine and public health, because unfortunately that is consistent with the same disparities that we have seen historically across health conditions for decades, quite frankly, before. So our hope is that any of the measures that we're looking at, we are looking at them with an equity lens to make sure that we are implementing strategies and infrastructure to be able to address the COVID-related aspects, but certainly looking to chip away at the systemic factors that continue to contribute to those disparities. I'll stop there. I'm happy to answer any questions if you have. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much. I think that was a nice overview. I think many of our advanced questions were somewhat addressed, but we'll kind of delve into them a little bit. As far as you were mentioning the total number of cases, I think we had a question from a physician asking about the total number of cases recorded for all of Montgomery County, including the demographics, and you brought up as far as equity. The state has that website. How accurate is that as far as following and the number of positive cases that we have? And what is that number?
The state website is up to date. It is updated on a daily basis. And actually, our case count is tied to the state site. So as of this morning, there was 42,323 confirmed cases in the state of Maryland, and 9,052 cases in Montgomery County. And when we look at the death count, that includes 474 residents in Montgomery County who've unfortunately passed away due to COVID-19.
Right, yeah, I see. So actually going on that, then do we have a sense as far as the impact of COVID on nursing homes or other congregate living facilities percentage-wise?
Sure. So I don't know the exact percentage, but unfortunately, we have been one of the jurisdictions that has been hit really hard within the nursing home population and assisted living facility population. We do have a significantly higher number of facilities in our county in comparison to others. I think when we put them all together, the assisted living facilities and the group homes and nursing homes, we have over 200, I think it's actually 303. So we've got a lot of facilities. Now, that said, one of the big things I want to highlight is within the majority of our nursing homes that have had cases is that we most of those cases started or popped up in late March and early to mid-April. And I bring that up because that was during the time period before we really started understanding that individuals who were asymptomatic could transmit to others. And up until that point, the guidance was if you're asymptomatic, you're okay. When you're symptomatic, we know that you're infectious and can transmit to others. And so that preceded many of those cases we think can be attributed to asymptomatic workers who, even in the setting of many of the facilities doing temperature checks, still came in. And so after April 8th was the date when stricter guidelines were put into place in terms of requiring dedicated PPE for each resident, and requiring face coverings in all of those different settings. Now, we have had some other cases pop up, don't get me wrong, and we have been actively working to address those. We created local action teams here in March, a week before the governor implemented the state action teams, and we've continued to provide additional guidance to facilities across the board. Unfortunately, we have had some facilities that have had a high number of cases as well as fatalities. And in that process, we have had the state action teams come in and provide additional consultation. And recently, the governor announced the state special operations team that is working with the National Guard that is coming in. I keep calling them the special ops team.
I think the strike team is what something like that.
So they've come in with the National Guard to provide testing for residents and staff, as well as additional guidance in terms of infection control. As of today, I think 25 of the 33 nursing homes have visits scheduled through this weekend. And we are working, again, what we're going to talk about tomorrow when we announce our high throughput option, we've been working on strategies to be able to take care of those other facilities that have yet to be scheduled, as well as increased testing opportunities for our assisted living facilities.
Okay, that's good. As a follow-up then, I think the hot topic is certainly all the testing, and everyone's asking about what the status of, you know, testing here is. You know, do we have a sense for, you know, is it going to jump up significantly further, for instance, for asymptomatic, being able to test asymptomatic patients? What are options do we have for regular testing of our office staff and medical practice? Will testing kits be sent to offices when available? Are we looking at these options as well?
So we've looked at a lot of options, and I want to emphasize that folks have a lot of options available right now.
Right.
So I think, you know, in fact, the healthcare infrastructure probably contributes the greatest percentage of tests, COVID-19 tests. Some of the things that have changed, I'll talk about some of the increased testing provisions that we put into place, but some of the things that have changed recently over the last 2 weeks is that CDC has put out guidance encouraging the testing of asymptomatic individuals. That correlates to an increased capacity of tests available to do that, because unfortunately we've had to operate under scarcity. We think back to the very beginning of this, the very, very strict guidelines, you know, folks had to call the health department and then we call the state and then we had to call CDC to get approval to actually do the test, to send it. Mm-hmm. And it's evolved as we have more capacity. So I say all that to say that we are encouraging providers in the community, if you have patients who are requesting tests, they're asymptomatic individuals, prioritizing individuals who are essential employees and first line responders, because they have been the folks who've had to come out and work over the last 2 months while many right. have been able to telework at home, as well as any asymptomatic individuals who are identified contacts to confirm COVID-19 cases. So encourage you as providers to test those folks in your offices. In addition to that, we've been looking at ways to offer lower, less invasive testing measures to be able to capture that asymptomatic population, because we know, and I know Dr. Sari will as the infectious disease expert will talk about this, is that is the true point of if we can identify as many people who fall into those that category and quickly get them isolated and interrupt their networks of transmission, that's going to be the key to cutting down on new cases.
So that's a great point as far as the testing, but the question is how do we access, or how do we get access to these testing? Are there, you know, county lines for us to be able to access? I mean, I'm a subspecialist, so I'm not sure where I can, you know, access and get some of these tests as far as all the kits. So you're saying that practices that are going through the normal venues to get, you know, viral testing kits is what they should be doing?
It's a host. So, I mean, anyone who contracts with LabCorp or Quest, they test. They do COVID-19 tests. We've actually even brokered a partnership with BioReference Lab as well. So if you contract with one of the large lab providers, you can get test kits through them and send them through those services. Now, from a county perspective, we've offered and actually partnering with those same labs. If you have patients who need to get access, you can order it through the CRISP system. And okay. they get an appointment scheduled to those alternative test sites. Individuals can also call the testing helpline at 240-777-1755, and they can be linked to a provider to triage and screen and provide that referral. In addition to that, as we scale up testing capacity, as I mentioned, there will be certainly opportunities to partner with facilities to be able to provide access to some of these less invasive testing mechanisms. So there's a host of options, again, that are available already and for folks to use.
Okay, so then as a follow-up to that, I saw that Governor Hogan had sent out a message, you know, saying that now two places are open in Prince George's County for drive-through for testing of asymptomatic patients, and giving pharmacists the ability to order tests as well as administer or even oversee people doing these testing. So that's Prince George's County. Are there any signs of seeing that happen in Montgomery County? Because certainly we're second highest as far as number of cases in the state.
Sure. So the governor's provisions actually technically only apply to Prince George's, those sites in Prince George's. I'll leave that alone. That said, you know, we have been working, so even preceding the governor's announcement yesterday and today, we have been working on how we can provide access to high throughput testing to be able to address that issue. And I want to be very clear, all of the different testing sites that we in Prince George, and this isn't knocking Prince George's, but Prince George's had one primary testing site, and now they've opened up. We've had three testing sites for a while now. And they have now they've run on an appointment and with a referral base, but we've tested over 1,800 individuals in that process, and so for those who don't have insurance, we've been able to cover the cost, and in other instances, we have billed insurance if others have those provisions. So I saw that to say that we're working on a strategy that will actually greatly expand beyond what they've done or the governor has announced recently. And we'll provide access again with some priority settings, though, you know, prioritizing our first line responders or nursing homes, assisted living facilities, and essential employees. And then as we move forward and increase capacity in that, we'll be able to offer up more opportunities for asymptomatic individuals within the community.
Okay. And before we move off of this testing, I think someone had asked to have that number again. That was 240-777.
1755.
So, Carissa, maybe if you could write that down and put that in the chat. And then just to clarify, so if we have a patient, we would order the test through CRISP, and they would then go to a drive-through site. And the only one we have right now is that in White Oak?
We have three. Actually, no. We have three. Okay. So there, again, you can order it if you use LabCorp or Quest. You can order a test through there, collect it, and send it through those mechanisms. If you're ordering it in CRISP, what will happen is once it's ordered and the patient's contact information is in, they will receive information to schedule their appointment. And then in that process, we have three different sites. Now, they're not operational every day of the week. The Veep station in White Oak is doing testing on Tuesdays and Thursdays. Yeah. The Wheaton Recreation Center on Wednesdays, and then the Uptown Regional Center on Mondays. And again, stay tuned. We're going to, once we can get our mobile testing army on board, and if you know of any, I know Susan mentioned this in last week's call, if there are any providers, particularly retired providers, who have an interest in participating in that, we'd be happy to have you. And the goal would be then to have additional resources to do pop-up testing at different venues throughout the county to provide testing.
Okay, that's great. We'll reach out to our members. So on the other side of that, after testing, let's talk about treatment and vaccine. So a couple of questions about that, about general things with the county. Do we have any plans this fall to expand county-sponsored flu vaccination clinics, particularly in schools or drive-through access? And then as a corollary to that, once the the COVID-19 vaccination, how do we envision providing that access? Would it be the same venue? It's a big question.
So that's a really large question. Quite frankly, I'm not being dismissive of the coronavirus vaccine component. Right now, we're still actively engaged on the coronavirus response.
Right.
That said, we have identified, and prioritizing the team is working on, and we talked about this in last week's call, encouraging families to get vaccines for their kids in particular. So the state put out a press release today, actually, not too long ago. And I chair the State Immunization Committee, and we actually have a special session next week to talk about putting out more language around that to encourage people to come in. Now, as a county, before COVID happened, we had been working with a number of entities to be able to increase our access to vaccines in school settings. We've worked with MCPS, and partnering with another agency. And so we've been able to work through all the logistical details and be able to increase offerings for that in the fall.
Right, and I think Dr. Half had mentioned in his call that physicians who were registered in or input into ImmuNet would have access to any future vaccine as well. So I think that's the advanced questions that we have. We can move on and maybe we can get to Dr. Sari, who can give us a little perspective. So it's my pleasure to welcome you, Dr. Sari. I just want to give a little intro here. Dr. Sari is a specialist in occupational medicine, travel medicine, infectious disease, and medical toxicology. You also said you're an epidemiologist. I hope I got everything on there as far as your credentialing. He is a medical director of the Occupational Health Consultants practice in Rockville. Certainly, we welcome your reactions to Dr. Gale's comments and your thoughts about sort of putting this all together on best practices on for physicians knowing what we have from the county, the statistics, and then testing capacity. We talked about asymptomatic carriers and how we can use this information to reopen our practices safely. Dr. Sari.
Thank you, Dr. Fan. I think I can answer that in one sentence. But seriously, I think this is really the 1918 Spanish flu. If we didn't have technology, we'd have 600,000 dead in the U.S., and there'd be millions of dead in the world, as there were 600 to 500 million people dead. This is not a virus that we should take lightly. It kills 20 times more efficiently than flu. It's maybe a couple of times more. The R-naught number is maybe two times that of flu, so it spreads easier. I think what we have unfortunately learned over time is that we started off with a case definition. Have you been to China? Do you have a fever, cough, shortness of breath? And it was easy to sort of identify a case at that time, but then as Dr. Gales and others realize that this particular infection had other manifestations, the flu-like symptoms, the loss of taste and smell, and even diarrhea and some gastrointestinal symptoms. But more disturbing is that a good number of them, 80%, had very little symptoms at all, which made it very difficult to identify those that were actually spreading the virus through the community. Unfortunately, the 20% that have symptoms, we've been really inundated with. And though 75% of that 20% don't really need anything more than maybe supplemental oxygen, the other 5% have been the ones that have created most of the stress and burden on the healthcare system with ICU requirements and intubation. I think what actually is even more disturbing than all of that is that we realize that this illness actually sheds virus 1 to 2 days before a person even has any symptoms. So before you have the fever and the cough and the shortness of breath, et cetera, you're shedding the virus. And as it turns out, this is where CDC is coming with their mitigation safety protocols of distancing and wearing a face covering, because this is really the most effective way of trying to control this virus from spreading in the community. I think that in 30 years of practice and having seen more than 10 emerging diseases and dealing with epidemics, I think for most epidemiologists like Dr. Gale, this isn't his first rodeo. He's certainly seen Ebola, he's certainly seen Zika, he's certainly seen a lot of diseases come through a community and realize the anxiety and the fear that each one of these emerging diseases causes, because the disease may change, but people don't change, and how they deal with it and how they react to it is different. I don't personally feel the media has been helpful. I think they've been stirring a lot of panic in the community and making it, and I must admit it is, I am tired of staying in place and, you know, doing all of these mitigation actions, just like every the rest of us. But I do think that people have to realize that there really is a new normal out there, whether you like it or not. You're going to have to distance yourself and wear a face covering and wash your hands a lot more frequently. And I must admit, in 20 years of being a chief of infection control, I can tell you that washing your hands is the most unnatural human act there is. However, touching your face is probably the most natural act. And so if you'll touch your face 25 times an hour, that's normal, but trying to get somebody to wash their hands every 20 minutes for 20 seconds is a mission impossible. So I think that we have to change our behavior, and that's the tough part. Not to mention that every time there's a recession, every time there's some type of economic downturn, the doctors get hit the worst, we recover the last. And with this one, I think we're going to have a problem because people are going to be scared of us. And unless we can effectively advertise what we're doing, how we're protecting our staff, how we're protecting our patients, it's going to be really tough to get people to come back and do the necessary follow-ups that they need for the concurrent illnesses, to get their biopsies and all their necessary surgeries done. I think it's a real challenge. I'll leave it at that at this point, but I'd be happy to answer any questions, as Dr. Gale is happy to do.
Well, thank you for that overview. As far as you were talking about the way that the virus and the viral shedding, can you speak to the sensitivity and specificity then of some of the different tests that are out there? For instance, you know, if you're capturing someone with the anterior nares test, I mean, certainly a patient can go home and swab themselves versus the full-on nasopharyngeal swab. I mean, if we do the anterior nares test, you know, what kind of PPE is involved with that? Is it any different than the nasopharyngeal swab? How is the sensitivity and specificity sort of vary depending upon time course of when you do it?
Well, you only ask the hard questions. Maybe I should let Dr. Gale answer this one.
Anybody.
Okay, well, I'll give a stab at it. There's obviously two tests that everybody has been hearing about, and it's the nucleic acid PCR test for the virus, initially with nasopharyngeal, and then oral pharyngeal has been a popular one with Abbott ID now. Some of the studies show that it doesn't actually pick up as much virus as the nasopharyngeal, but at the same time, over time, with the disease, if you do the test a little later on in the disease, you're not going to get as much efficiency from the nasopharyngeal because it's moved down into the lungs. The antibody test is it's kind of like the Wild West out there because there's about 144 antibody tests that have been marketed because of the FDA's relaxation of their surveillance or their licensing. So there are about 144 that are applying for EUAs. Some of the tests are worthless. Some of the tests are very good. Most of the tests are from China. Probably the better ones are from Hong Kong. They will identify IgM, IgG. The earliest you can pick that up on any of these tests in studies have been 5 days. Usually a week is better. Then you'll be able to pick up the IgM. If you can pick up, the sensitivity is better if you try to look for both of them. I've certainly have used that down in the Gulf Coast with some of the petrochemical companies who are trying to screen their people before they go offshore. We've used a variety of PCRs, a variety of antibody tests, and they seem to work if you time them appropriately. But that wasn't ever the purpose of these tests. They weren't for necessarily for screening people. They were more for diagnosis in a high-risk population, hospitalized population for the PCR. They were used for serosurveillance as a serology test. I think what Dr. Birx said almost a month ago was that the only way that we were going to effectively open our society up was to have an antigen test. And that is another level, another order of complexity, but it is, and it's harder to do because you essentially have to do animal studies and these require level three biosafety level research facilities to develop the antibodies. But nevertheless, you can develop essentially the equivalent of a pregnancy test. And if you gave, sold these or gave them to people and they could test it in their homes, they could essentially tell if they're positive or not. And she said that it would take about 20 million of these tests throughout the entire United States to effectively open up the United States. Now, I don't know if 20 million is the right answer or 200 million is the right answer, but I do think that there's some limitations. We're dealing with it now with companies. I consult for a lot of major international companies that are trying to figure out how do they get their people back into work, and do they need to screen everybody with antigen tests, the PCR test or the antibody test, or do they simply just do a temperature check and ask them if they have any symptoms? I don't know if there's any good efficiency with any of those, especially with the reality that you can be shedding this virus without any symptoms at all, no fever, no symptoms. And so it really comes down to everybody has to follow some mitigation. None of these tests get you out of following the CDC guidelines for social distancing, washing your hands frequently, using a face cover, things like that. So I think that's the best short answer I can give you on testing.
I see. These are actually questions from our members. I'm their voice. So they're asking the hard questions and very excellent questions. In fact, in response and follow-up to that, speaking of the antigen test, the point of care testing, the 15-minute Kydell test approved by the FDA, what do you envision as far as it moving forward? What's the role there? Do you know the sensitivity and specificity?
Well, the sensitivity and specificities are of the ones that you believe are, and the ones that at least FDA has approved, which is about a dozen, is over 95%. But the problem is that if the disease has a prevalence of 5% currently in the U.S., I'm not saying New York City or hotspots, but in general, then the predictive value of those tests are pretty worthless. You're going to have a lot of very low predictive values for positive and negative tests. And so that's just a problem with any test, no matter how good you are with those tests.
I see. Do we have access to that now?
Okay, so that's the second problem that at least I have noticed, is that there isn't enough. And though I think Governor Hogan has done a remarkable job of getting us some tested to work our high risk populations like nursing homes and prisons. As Dr. Gales was mentioning in this afternoon in the 5 o'clock news that I watched, I think that the problem is that CDC has pretty much prioritized these tests because they're in short supply to a high priority healthcare workers, inpatients, first responders, people who are at high risk, who have been exposed. And then at the very end, at the third tier, is those who are essentially in critical infrastructure industries or essential personnel. The regular guy who's working in an office isn't going to have access, or is going to have to wait in line in front of these others that really have more of a priority and a need to have the test until they become more available. And I don't know if Dr. Gales has any idea if there's going to be a flood of these tests. I've not seen them.
Right.
Though I must admit, it has been a major improvement with LabCorp and Quest being able to give us results. It used to take 5 days from Quest. Now it only takes 2 days. I can even get the serology test, which is only, unfortunately, IgG, back the next day. I have used Dr. Gale, or not Dr. Gale's, but I have used the CRISP system. And the downside to that is that they don't send me the report. The person who gets it has to call a number, but they won't send it to the doctor. So I don't know, even though I authorized it, whether or not the test was positive or not. I have to sort of touch base with the patient. Dr. Gales, is there anything you wanted to add to that?
We were trying to keep track of those 500,000 tests that we had obtained from South Korea at an undisclosed location. Has there been any plans for an allocation of those resources? Because I know tests are tests, but someone's got to administer them as well. That's a lot of tests. Where are they?
That's a great question. I'll be perfectly candid. And I don't want to sound dismissive at all, but we're still waiting to find out those tests. So when the tests were delivered, the tests did not have reagents or swabs to go with them.
I'm sorry, Carissa, can you mute?
It's Susan, I'm looking.
Yes. Okay, Dr. Minarata, please mute yourself. Thank you.
Okay.
Sorry, Dr. Gales.
No worries. So it has taken weeks to operationalize them. And then I think the governor said they're not actually kits. They're parts of the components. So I say all that to say that we have not actually been sent, you know, kits from the South Korea batch. So I don't know. I think they are possibly being used for my understanding, they're not kits, but they're part of components for the lab. And so the thought is that potentially those provisions are being used to help read a lot of the tests. Now, you know, with the comments that, you know, there's going to be requirement for, you know, prisons to be tested, nursing homes mm-hmm. to be tested. So the thought is, as best as I can piece together, that that's what they're being used for to help run at the state level. Now, that said, the state has made provisions within the last 24 hours. We're still getting details on this, but they have made provisions with a partnership with a private laboratory to send weekly allocations to jurisdictions to be able to test, and they will be covered by the state. So the state has been active in the testing arena. I think the thing to underscore is we've all been active in the testing arena, trying to figure out one, who are the labs who can handle capacity? What are the legit labs? And then to Dr. Sari's point is, we get hit with 50 different options of different types of tests. Is this a rapid test? This is a self-collection test. This is an antigen test. And the issue is, we don't have the most extensive information to be able to decide which is the right one. So in the instance of the Abbott, you know, rapid test, everyone was like, you got to buy this one. And now, you know, several weeks later, there are concerns about false negatives. So it's a precarious balance. And okay. I think to that end, the serum test is one of those where we're waiting to get more information before moving forward in terms of how to utilize those.
Okay, so we'll stay tuned.
I will say one thing, if I can, Dr. Fan, to what Dr. Gales was saying, is that I had followed SARS and MERS for the past 18 years with interest. That was my specialty in the military in infectious disease. But the what we know about these particular coronaviruses, these severe coronaviruses, is they act a particular way, they're spread a particular way. They develop a T-cell immunity that offers them about 4 years of immunity for people who have developed antibodies. The antibodies that you're picking up really isn't reflecting what the T-cell response is, but if you look at their cousins, if you look at COVID's cousins, which are SARS and MERS, it's acting the same way. And so in many ways, I think that though I may be speaking as the heretic in the group of WHO and CDC, I do think that having antibodies is a good thing. And it probably means that you're protective and that there is no chronic condition, because people are worried that, gee, is this a chronic disease, a chronic spreader? You know, am I going to always carry this and spread it to my loved ones? This isn't the way these coronaviruses act. So I think we can be at least optimistic, though I don't see anybody that's ever reported any optimism in the news about anything like a serology passport or whatever. But I do think that if the tests are good, and I think that all of these tests, and I have purchased tens of thousands of these for my clients down in the Gulf Coast, and they're all from China. They're all very good. They turn out to be very good, but they're only good because we have required that we do some internal validation of these tests, because they have not been validated. And so we want to make sure that what we're using is not a pig in a poke, that it's actually a good test. And we found the Hong Kong test to be, the antibody test to be very good. We've also found the China CDC version of the PCR to be very good. But we need to validate it and not just accept whatever somebody is selling.
Okay. Well, I certainly want to pull us back to the other question at hand as far as opening the practices. I know one big question was certainly, you know, Governor Hogan's executive order saying that we're able to see non-urgent and elective patients in the office, provided we attest that we have a certain amount of PPE. But then the county executive extended our stay-at-home order. Which one supersedes, or we can kind of work within that, or how does that work? Because we had some questions from members. Okay. Sort of wanting some clarity on that point.
Yeah, so the order related to elective procedures actually is from the Secretary of Health, Robert Neal. So that was from May 6th. So the governor's directive and order that our stay-at-home order applies to the governor's phase one reopening. So I say all that to say that elective procedures can move forward, again, okay, if those criteria are met, as laid out by the Secretary's directive for May 6th.
Okay, and then for offices that need some urgent help attaining PPE, are there some resources that they should be looking? We're trying to do our best at, you know, the Medical Society, but are there any other, you know, are there county resources or how, you know, even things like paper towels and soap? I mean, the best thing is to wash your hands, but even getting some of that in the grocery store is out, hand sanitizers or even, you know, Pampers or whatnot.
So I'll be perfectly candid. I mean, there's going to be short supply for everybody and not the opportunity from the county perspective to provide endless supply to everyone. But that said, there is, as you mentioned earlier, you can complete a form with the county emergency public health emergency preparedness team, and who oversees the allocation of the PPE process, and submit your need and a request, and then they'll respond and get back to you. I do know that for in many situations, because there's such a large volume of folks requesting, we've had folks come to the Dennis Avenue location and pick up. We have a process in place where there's staff out there who can provide you and check your reservation and be able to provide those services. And it is it's a reality that, and quite frankly, I think this is a failure of the federal government, is we've been struggling for PPE to do business in terms of responding. And I don't think folks have thought about the fact that, you know, to Dr. Sari's point earlier, there is going to be a new normal as things reopen, and that's going to require masks and more PPE in terms of providing services. Right. So we're hopeful that we can continue to get the provisions in order to be able to take care of those who need it in healthcare settings, but certainly as it opens up. And I will say this is one of the benefits of less invasive testing mechanisms and measures, because they will require less. You can test more people to know their status, but then they, you know, those testing mechanisms won't require the higher level of PPE for administration.
I absolutely agree, because as an otolaryngologist, I know how hard it is to do a nasopharyngeal swab and, you know, they're sneezing and coughing. So that's a good point. There's a couple of, you know, more sort of general advice questions from some of our physicians. For example, if you're a certain age, you know, I have one member who's 85 and feels fine. He's been home for 2 months, but this physician would like to get back to, you know, practice. Is this something, Dr. Sari, that you think would be, is this reasonable? Also, you know, sort of another example of returning back to practice, someone like a medical esthetician in a, you know, aesthetic type of practice, or are we sort of not saying, you know, passing judgment on it, everyone needs to have their care, but just some examples of whether or not these people, these types of people can return to work.
Well, it's a tough question, because, you know, I remember GERDs, probably no one else remembers it, but back in 1980, that's what they called AIDS. And that's where I saw my first AIDS patients, and I couldn't get doctors to see my patients. I couldn't get subspecialists to see them. People were scared because they didn't know what it was. There was no treatment for it. I think that to answer a question of someone who's at high risk, who's a healthcare provider who wants to go back to work or volunteer, I think that one of the things that is hopeful, and I think real hope, is that the antivirals that have been studied are serving that bridge until we have a vaccine. Mm-hmm. And so I think there's been some great results with some of the antiretroviral agents, some of the monoclonal immune modulators that have been tried, albeit so many of them are based on a very thin amount of scientific data or animal studies or maybe just biological plausibility, but they've been thrown in the mix and studied. There is data that does suggest that all of these antivirals might be helpful, but timing is so important. It's like Tamiflu. If I give my patient Tamiflu 6 hours after the onset of their symptoms, they're going to have 4 days less of symptoms. But if I wait 2 days and then give them Tamiflu, it doesn't work. Right. And that's the timing aspect of this. And so most of the studies that you're seeing of all of these current drugs are given to people who have already been 5 days into their disease. They're already in the ICU. They're already, you know, in dire distress. And I'm not surprised that some of these antivirals aren't able to turn the corner of these people and make them better. But if they had given it to them earlier, if they had, and I'm even including hydroxychloroquine and azithromycin and zinc, which I have given to my patients, And though I only have several anecdotal reports, I don't have science backing it, it does seem that it did maybe help them not progress to the point that they had to enter a hospital. But it isn't science, and I know that people's desire for a cure is getting ahead of science and accuracy, but there is an urgency to get people back. And I think that one thing for an older high-risk individual is to know that if they were to get sick, there's probably some really effective treatments now that have proven themselves that could be used to help them and maybe even prophylax them. But we just, I think those studies are probably still a month to a month and a half away, but I think they serve as the bridge until we have a vaccine that's going to protect our high-risk individuals. That's the best answer I have.
Okay, well, thank you. I know it's getting late, but I know that there's several more important questions I want to get to. So talking about on the treatment end, some practical, advice. There's been physicians who've seen patients whose tests have been positive for over 4 weeks. They're asymptomatic, but swabs are still positive. Are they still contagious? So, what advice are physicians, should they provide in terms of their workplace and return to work? Does this suggest that they're chronic carriers? Because I know the CDC has their time-based versus, symptom-based or time-based or versus testing-based strategy, but in this case, they're testing positive.
Well, they're switched to a time versus a test strategy is really de facto statements that they don't feel that there is chronic shedding going on. There is prolonged shedding in some people. So I will say that if I did take a hospitalized individual who's immunosuppressed, they've been intubated, they're going to shed another week longer than other people who had had the disease. And so I would tend to hold them back longer. But the PCR test, unfortunately, is so sensitive that it really doesn't distinguish between live infectious virion versus just viral parts. And that's been the problem with the Emerald Princess and doing studies there, looking for a virus 17 days after everybody's gone. They're just picking up particles. They're not really picking up a virus. And South Korea and China have actually done some recent studies that have shown that there really isn't persistent chronic shedding of live agents beyond probably 10 days. And that's why CDC essentially changed their recommendation from 7 to 10 for healthcare workers who are working with immunosuppressed and obviously people at high risk in the hospital, because they wanted to capture those individuals who might be shedding a little bit longer. At the same time, if I had antibody studies that showed that I had IgG present, it would be very similar to what I would see with most viral infections. At the first onset of IgG, there's viral clearance in the body. And so you don't expect them to be shedding if you have IgG. So maybe the combination of not a qualitative, but maybe a quantitative serology test that isn't available in too many places in the U.S. would be able to give people confidence that these people are not, infectious. And I feel that someone who's had the disease, who has recovered and is asymptomatic and has gone 10 days, they're not at risk to care for patients or a risk to their family necessarily.
So it sounds like we should stick with the hand hygiene and the wearing the face covering. So just assume that as far as protection. But then that leads certainly to another physician's question, that if patients are not showing symptoms, the day before they're seen by the provider. So for instance, let's say the patient comes in and they're coming in the day before they begin to show even the symptoms, but they've already been seen. So does that have implications for saying that the nursing staff and physicians should be wearing surgical masks or N95s? I guess it may depend upon what they're their specialty is? Are you counseling physicians to wear N95s to assume everyone's positive? I mean, Dr. Gales?
I think
they've screened negative.
Dr. Gales could probably talk to the CDC recommendations, which are primarily what will take a person from a low risk to a moderate risk, which requires them to be 14 days, you know, if they can, in some type of isolation. The key risk assessment in that is, were they both wearing masks or face coverings when they were within 6 feet of each other? So I think that to me, the important thing is that everybody should be wearing a face shield. And I don't wear a N95 unless I'm inducing a swab. Unless if I think I'm going to deal with an aerosolized, aerosol-producing activity, I'm not going to wear an N95, but if I am, I'm going to wear a face shield, N95, and some eye protection. But generally, I just wear a surgical mask, and I want the patient to wear a surgical mask, and that's how I practice. And we do disinfect the rooms after they come in, and we run them in. We don't keep them in the waiting rooms. We do all the things that the county society is requesting that we validate that we do. But I don't think that, to me, I would be more concerned if this was measles, which is a lot more infectious. It's aerosol.
I see.
Then we're in trouble. I'd be more concerned if this was Ebola, where you have a million virion per cc of stool, and they're having diarrhea. You know, it's very hard to be able to stay uncontaminated in that type of setting. But this is essentially the common cold. This is the flu. This is something that we deal with all the time. It's not anything different, and our measures that we've used for these others will work. The consequences, though, if we don't, are grave, because this is, again, 20 times more lethal. And but nevertheless, I think that there's a point where we can't go in spacesuits or PAPRs to see our patients.
They're not really available.
ENT is a special situation where you are generating aerosols. It is a problem. Mm-hmm. I don't see you getting out of wearing an N95. But at the same time, I think that for the rest of us, like internists, unless I'm going to be doing a procedure that's going to perhaps induce an aerosol, I'm just going to wear a surgical mask and some eye protection.
Okay. Well, that makes a lot of sense. I just want to bring this back then to Dr. Gales and another chat question that we had here, where we had a physician concerned about vaccinations. Is Montgomery County providing any public encouragement, like, you know, some PSAs to encourage parents to bring their kids into the pediatrician? Would you say that it's publicly safe for them to use primary care offices for routine care? I think we had touched on that as far as uniform messaging to try to get patients back into, you know, the office and say it is safe. I don't know if anything has rolled out yet.
No, we haven't rolled anything out, but we're working on it.
Okay, great. So really with that, you know, I'd like to thank you, Dr. Gales and Dr. Sari, for being with us, for your insights and expertise. I don't know if there's any telephone questions on the phone tonight. Certainly, it could take one or two. You can hit *6 to unmute yourself, but you should say your name and to whom the question is addressed to. So if you just give me 2 more minutes of your time. And I think it sounds like everybody is ready to go. Yeah, exactly. So, you know, before we sign off, I'd like to remind everyone, you know, we sent out a survey released on Monday. It's about the implications of COVID-19 on you, your practice, on your patients. Really, we encourage you to complete the survey, because our local elected leaders are looking at some possible funding sources. to ensure adequate access to care during and after COVID. And I think, you know, these are a lot of things we're looking at as far as unanticipated consequences, the care of chronic condition patients after COVID. And even now during. So certainly we wanna thank you for joining us for this important update. There is a link to the survey on the chat. Watch for your email for the information about the next call with Dr. Gales on June 3rd. And remember, MCMS and MedCHI are here for you. Please get in touch if we can assist you with any questions you may have. We encourage you to take care of yourself so you can take care of your patients. And again, I wish you all a good night. Thank you.
Take care. Mm-hmm.